The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Good morning, Ilya Friedman. How the heck are you doing?
Good morning, Ben Rock. I'm doing just fine. How about you?
I'm doing great. Welcome to another kick-ass episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Who is on our show? Come on, hit me.
We have DP Paul Guillaume. He is the DP of the very, very well-publicized and talked-about movie, Emilia Perez.
That is a great way to describe it.
It is. Yes. It's an ambitious movie, and personally, I enjoyed it. I know there's a lot of people out there who were polarized or hated this movie, but I liked it. I really, it's melodrama, and I think melodrama is really difficult for people to get behind sometimes. And it's got some silly, ridiculous parts. It's got some super dramatic parts. It has, and in the interview, I think we talk about all those parts. We talk about those things, and I think it's a great interview. And if you saw Emilia Perez,
and he is Oscar nominated.
He is
Oscar nominated cinematographer.
Exactly, so. And that is one of the most awarded and decorated movies this year, and it's a great story. It started off as a relatively low budget sort of indie production. It got acquired by Netflix and brought to worldwide acclaim. So it's definitely worth your time to check out, and it's definitely worth diving into some of the controversy if that's the sort of thing that you're into as well.
Yeah, but I mean, the controversy all has to do with its lead actress, and Paze and I talked about it in our host wraps.
You did
last week. We don't need to get into it. I guess it was 2 weeks ago. We don't really need to get into it again, but it bums me out when one person's behavior can sink a whole ship, and I often. I'm not really making this direct comparison at all, because to me, like, tweeting mean things is not doing mean things. But, there are movies like The Usual Suspects that I love. I just love that movie so much. And it kind of doesn't matter to me. The people who were involved with it turned out not to be the most wonderful people, a couple of them. Mm-hmm. Tom Siegel's cinematography, freaking amazing.
Incredible.
Every performance in the movie, freaking amazing. Like, the writing, the way Chris McQuarrie wrote that script, friggin' amazing. And I guess I'd like to make a little bit of a cautionary tale about, like, let's not write off a whole movie because one person involved with it turned out to maybe not be someone you wanted to, have brunch with.
Yeah, I think that's fair. All right, so Ben.
And now, Close Focus.
It is our Close Focus time of the show. It's when we talk about something topical, something that is going on in the world. We will get to that interview in just a couple of minutes. So Ben, what do we have to chat about? What is our Close Focus? What is topical?
Well, I think, like, we're rounding the season into the Oscars. In fact, we're going to be doing our annual Oscar roundup with our friend Janelle Riley, who's an editor at Variety. Mm-hmm. And she writes extensively about the Oscars and interviews all the Oscar nominees. We're going to be doing that later this week.
It's always a good time. If you've never heard Janelle Riley on this show, we've got like years and years worth of our conversations, and it's going to be great, I'm sure, again.
I think it's fair to say Janelle Riley is way more entertaining and better talking about the stuff than you and me put together.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She knows her crap like nobody in this business. Yeah. She's really good.
Also just freaking funny. We're here to talk about the award season, which is upon us. We've had the Golden Globes, which you and I both don't really take that seriously.
Nope.
Slightly more seriously, much more seriously, this last couple of days were the BAFTAs. Now, here's my question, and actually this is probably something I will ask Janelle when we talk to her tomorrow, is like, how much of an indicator of who's going to win the Oscar are the BAFTAs? Because it's a very similar list of people and films. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but, we had it's like a lot of the same movies: Anora, Conclave, The Brutalist, Dune 2, Emilia Perez, The Substance, I just listed, by the way, Best Director nominees. And it's interesting to see who's getting nominated and who's winning. And also, is it going to, I don't think it affects the Oscars because I think Oscar voting is already closed. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong, but I doubt that it'll affect it. But like, how much will it
predict? Yeah. I don't think much at all. But it is I don't think necessarily much at all. I've noticed over the years that the BAFTAs have definitely gone different ways. I think occasionally there's overlap. And
the BAFTAs, by the way, we didn't say it. It's the British Academy Awards.
Exactly.
It's the Oscars in England. So they have posher accents and, you know, I think David Tennant hosted.
There's far less slapping going on. There's really a lot less.
We've only had one slap. To be fair, in the histories of the Oscars, we've only had one slap. I mean, like,
to be fair, that's 100% more than the BAFTAs.
That is true. Both of us have just done a masterclass in misusing statistics. Anyway, one slap is too many. We could talk through, you know, the Best Picture nominees were Anora, The Brutalist, A Complete Unknown, Conclave, and Emilia Perez. Conclave won. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go through all the actor and actress stuff because that's really not what we talk about. But I will talk about director because I feel like that is definitely fist in glove with cinematography. So you've got Anora, The Brutalist, Conclave, Dune Part 2, Emilia Perez, and The Substance. Of course, I'm like, go Substance. But The Brutalist by Brady Corbet won. And can't argue with that. Freaking great movie. Mm-hmm. And
also one for cinematography.
Yep. I was just going to get to that.
Okay. So, I stole your thunder. Oh no.
No, it's fine. So for cinematography, it's a very similar list to the Oscars. It's The Brutalist, Conclave, Dune Part 2, Emilia Perez, and Nosferatu, and The Brutalist one, and Lal Crowley, who we had on the show and who is a delight, a wonderful guy. He won. So you think this has? I mean, like, I feel like all of the same people could win in at the Oscars, but you don't think that this indicates anything at all?
Not necessarily. I know the demographics are pretty similar to of the the BAFTA sort of crowd to the Academy crowd, but look. I think only when there's sort of like overwhelming acclaim, it seems to me in years past, there's quite a bit of divergence. They don't always go the same way. So I don't think it's I don't think it influences voting. I think usually voting is closed by the time the BAFTAs are out. So I believe voting is closed now. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens. Yeah, the Academy, I don't think that one definitely influences the other, but sometimes I think there's overlap for sure. So I what's going to happen this year, I really don't know. But the BAFTAs are they're a kick butt show, and I hear they're really well put on, and that look, they have
you can watch it again. I think yeah. David Tennant was the host.
Exactly.
And yeah, they're just as well produced as the Oscars. I'm sure whoever produces the Oscars would punch me in the face for that. But but it's a big freaking deal, the BAFTAs. And I feel like I don't know that we've ever really like highlighted the BAFTAs before.
Yeah. And less face slaps. So it's got everything.
It's got everything except face slaps.
Yeah.
Speaking about it's got everything. SNL 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
No Stefan.
Oh,
I was so bummed out.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill Hader did not attend. So I understand. So I haven't seen it. Yeah.
Oh, I saw it. I thought it was mostly good, kind of up its own butt a bit, but it was mostly really good. And it was great to see some of those people. And in some cases, kind of like, oh boy, that person's way crazy older than I thought that they would be.
Gotcha. Yeah. Did this have any sort of connection at all to the whole Saturday Night Movie that just came out? Was there any sort of like, referencing or?
No, they didn't really talk. Like Lauren Michaels was barely in. There were a couple of shots of Lauren Michaels like towards the end. But no, they didn't. They didn't bring up the Saturday Night Movie. That's interesting.
Okay,
they probably should have. I mean, like that movie is nothing but a sloppy hug to Saturday Night Live. I mean, like I love the movie, but you know, I don't know. Not to get off on too much of a tangent here, but the weirdest thing about the SNL 50th were like the people who weren't there or who like I felt like were snubbed, like Dana Carvey. No presence of Dana Carvey there. No Dan Aykroyd. There were some classic clips of each one of them that were shown, so maybe they just couldn't be there for some reason. But don't you think if you made your career on SNL, that you would kind of make a point of being there. Eddie Murphy was in it a lot, and he was actually hilarious.
Oh, fantastic. All right. So, Ben, I think this is a great point for us to transition to our interview with Paul Gilliam.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Paul Gilliam, the cinematographer of the ambitious and very much spoken about Emilia Perez, which is everywhere right now, including on Netflix, where you can go check it out if you want to hear what all the hubbub is about. Paul, thank you so much for being on the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is a extremely international movie, which combines elements that I don't think I've ever seen in any movie before. And it's been extremely celebrated at film festivals around the world. Not to mention, though, boy, does Hollywood and the media love a good story. So there's a ton being written about comments and cancel culture and all kinds of things right now. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I think that the movie itself is a fantastic melodrama. And melodrama is such an incredibly difficult thing to do. And as a matter of fact, melodrama almost becomes a dirty word, I feel like, out there, because people use it to describe other things as, you know, going off the rails, going into melodrama. But when melodrama is done really, you know, really well, especially as a crime musical melodrama that this is, it can be enchanting. And I think that there is this incredible polarization that comes from this movie. When I look at reviews from a few months ago, it's really heartening to see sort of like the march forward. Tell me about the early days of Emilia Perez. Tell me about getting the script and it all sort of coming together. And what did you think when you read this? You know, it's a crazy story. If you could give our listeners the little synopsis of what the story is and what you thought when you read it for the first time.
Well, the first time I read it, it was more like an opera, and Jax was not even sure it was going to be shot at all. So he told me that maybe it will capture on stage a performance that was basically this canvas, and it shifted at one point. He wanted to do something maybe more grounded. But realized pretty soon that he wanted the film to be actually away from reality, and he wanted to do something that's still an opera, has songs intertwined inside the story, and to shoot on a studio on a soundstage, just to be able to create a strange world that's switching on and off and looks more like a stage. Even though this degree of visual realism kept on evolving during the preparation.
Yeah, it's it is very much like an opera or like a play. And I was struck by that several times. In fact, can you talk a little bit about the switching of the back and forth, you know, because you've got this character who ostensibly wants to be someone that they're not currently at the beginning of the movie. And then I think we're all kind of just waiting for the moment when they revert to their nature as a brutal psychopath. Can you talk about it all sort of like, you know, your visual development of the characters as they go through the story?
Well, at the beginning of the story, we are just like in Rita's point of view. So it's when we discover Manitas, that's still Manitas, we barely see him in the shadow of the trailer, and we are just struggling to just get the figures of Manitas, and we really only clearly see this character when the sun is arriving. That's after Manitas is gone, and now it's Emilio, but the movie is like there is something a bit like a very classic drama or very classic structure, the structure of a play almost, and that's the faith and the actions of the past that you cannot just swipe, and they come back, and the darkness comes back in the film at the end.
It certainly is, and I think it's quite interesting how you transition and move from what feels grounded and real to what is heightened and over the top. And I think that's actually what melodrama can do well. And I think musicals is, I've never seen a movie like this. So, and sometimes I feel like the musical numbers try to be a little bit more grounded. And sometimes I feel like they just go completely over the top. Can you talk at all about the conversations that you had with Jacques about how to decide when to go one way and when to go the other?
Yeah. So that was actually very much present from the start. The ambition of the scriptwriters was to integrate the musical numbers into the story, and the reality is that you almost cannot really edit them out of the film, these musical numbers, because the drama is unfolding during the musical numbers, and you learn things or either that are emotionally important or story-wise important, and you cannot really get rid of those. And so the answer about how to film those numbers was very often written into the script. Is it a very intimate moment, for example, that just needs to be shot like a shot reverse and a very classic conversation between two people? Or is it something much more like a show within the show, you know, like the fundraising gala, for example. It's like it's Zoe's character's moment, and she takes control of the film, of the camera, of the light, and that's much more like maybe close to the classical musical, or even maybe like a little music video within the film at this moment.
I'm glad you brought that scene up, because just directly preceding that, just like a few moments in the story just preceding that, is Aquí Estoy, and the musical number, which to me feels like both the middle of the movie and sort of the turning point of what's happening. And I think that Aquí Estoy might be, you know, the most dramatic and the most beautiful of all the songs that are there. But it's then sort of, you start to see from that moment, you know, the introduction of new characters and potential new stresses or potential, it feels to me like the movie starts to chip away at the facade that everything is going to be okay and that everything is going to work out. And it starts there. And by the time that you get to that, the gala dinner, I feel like, you know, things are starting to come apart, and that we only really get to see how far apart they come over the next few scenes. Can you talk about a little bit sort of, you know, what happens with the visuals at this point? Because I feel like after Aquí Estoy, which is much more, I want to say much more like high key sort of lit, with the exception potentially of the faces and voices, the rest of the movie becomes more like the introduction, becomes harder light, especially that big gala scene. And there becomes way more contrast and way more handheld and way more frenetic. And I feel like it's introduced slowly at this turning point, and then it becomes more and more and more and more until we get to the end. Was this your plan for the visual style? How did the looks change? And tell me about this.
Actually, yeah. the center of the film, the light, was supposed to be maybe more classical, like something you even can forget. It's like the light bouncing from outside, from the sky, you know, from the sun. It's regular daylight, I would say. And this scene you mentioned is we try to find volume and contrast, but in a natural way, really, and that's lit using very classic techniques of muslin outside that we bounce strong HMIs inside and just have continuity in our interior, because that scene is not shot in the studio, it's shot in a place that we actually prepped the film and then it's like the night is coming back into the story and everything gets much darker, and when we are in the gala, we're just like almost like on a stage, it's black walls, and you have these four theater lights on each corners, able to converge on the same spot that's operated by a theater operator, actually, mm-hmm. through an infrared camera, and that's much more like a play again at this moment of the film. So and the film really ends into a kind of night that's supposed to be a bit less realistic than the first kind of nights that we see in the film, that where we use practical lights. In the end of the film, it's more like a cinema light from a crane, from the transparent ceiling almost in the restaurant at the end, and that's more like something that we wanted to be almost gray without any highlights, as opposed to the first part of the film.
I want to go back a little bit to, you know, your initial reactions like to reading this as a play, because you've got people losing fingers, but you also have songs where the lyrics which have gone viral about gender affirming care. So tell me about just the for you, all of the different stuff in this movie, and then what your thoughts were to how to bring that to the screen.
The first time I read it, it was just basically five acts and written like a little libretto, but it was more like the content of the acts than the music was done later in the process of the preparation. And so when I read it the first time, there's this very classical structure into the script. If you just write it down, it's just like a classical five acts play, and that was what struck me. It was like it was strong because of the simplicity of this narrative structure, and you can feel that around it. Especially with the music, Jax built something like, yeah, with a lot of variations, a lot of different styles, and exploring very deeply into each styles. But the structure in the end is very simple. And that's what I like a lot in cinema, is when you can feel that the way it's made maybe is messy or not completely traditional, but in the end, it's like the bones of the story are super classical, and it's something that I think is strong.
Okay, so how do you unify the looks? How do you go into like the comedy and the drama, and you keep it all feeling like it's the same movie? I mean, I know that you could say technically like there's the grade, but I mean your lighting changes, your style changes. How do you make it feel so seamless through it? I know it's a great story, good bones to work with, but your work. How do you do it? Yeah.
You're right to talk about the grade, because the grade is a final unifier of everything, and you can unify through textures and contrasts and color palette. It actually just makes things blend together. But the truth is that Jax has an aesthetic really of movement, and you can see through all of his films, from A Prophet to Rust and Bones. or Paris 13th district, all of these different kind styles of our explorations, there's one thing in common. It's that the camera is almost never still, almost never fixed. And the image, there's something in motion always in each and every frame that's happening. And he keeps on, and that's something also that he does in the edit, process. You can feel like if you mute the film, your eye is kind of dragged from one place of the screen to the other, and in the cut, they just take your eye exactly where you were, and bring it to another place, and you are like it's your eyes is always in motion. Maybe the only moment where it doesn't happen would be in shot reverse scenes. But even then, and he's absolutely not the only one to do that, but it's like it's in aesthetic continuity. A shot reverse will almost never be shot on a still dolly, for example, because he's not interested into photographic composition as opposed to just cinematographic composition. That means that he rather writes through movement than through pure compositions. And that's something that I noticed, one of the, I think to me, most beautifully shot films in French cinema is A Prophet, that he shot with Stéphane Fontaine. And his work in A Prophet is stunning. But as a student, I tried one day to take some grabs of the film, and just to be able to understand why it was so powerful and so impactful, the image of the film. And the thing is, it's pretty hard to make still images of A Prophet. When you look at it, it's wonderful and it works perfectly. But if you pose it, it kind of just doesn't work anymore, because it needs the movement and the motion to work together, actually. So a lot of frames are tight and always in motion. So when you pose it, for example, there will be some motion blur, you know, in the image. And that's just because what counts is more the stream than just the photographic still image. And it's something that you can see in all of his cinema. It's a constant.
I'm so glad that you brought up the framing and the composition and the camera movement. I was hoping that you would get into this. I didn't want to express my opinion onto you here, but this is to me what is actually part of what makes Emilia Perez work so well, is that the camera is always in motion and there's a pacing that goes with it. It's like a musical pacing almost with the camera as it's moving from scene to scene and sequence to sequence, and such incredible transitions sometimes to get you in and get you out of these different sequences, and to even these very, very clever shots. I think of like, scenes like Selena Gomez riding in the car, and there's when she's meeting her new lover, and there's this low angle that is on her and looking up, at his face. It's like there's so much interesting stuff. There's always these interesting angles and things. Can you talk a little bit about how you find those moments? Because there's so many traditional ways to shoot something. And I feel like you didn't go with most, like you have your shot reverse, of course, but there's so many wonderful flowing steady cam and moving into dance numbers and coming out of dance numbers. And it works so well. And I think this is why you were nominated for an Academy Award here, is because I think that, your lighting is great, but so much of this is in composition and how the composition changes and is energetic and is always interesting. Can you just talk a little bit about how this comes about? Yeah.
Well, there's one thing. As a cinematographer, you meet directors that almost don't want to prep at all. You meet directors that need to have the whole film frame by frame decided in advance. And Jacques is somewhere in the middle, but in an interesting way. What he tries to have solved for each scene is, of course, there is a blocking, a découpage, that's the idea of what we are going to do, but he tries to find a single image per scene. And this concept, I think I will just it will stay with me because it's a very powerful concept in the preparation of a film. The idea of finding one strong image is like, what is the visual memory you'll keep when this particular scene is gone, when it's over. And in the movie Dipan, for example, it's Sertet, it's a thing that that produces light on the head of the guy in a red blinking toy in the night, for example, for one scene. It's like, it's one strong image, and it's not necessarily an image in a sense of, again, a photography. It's a visual memory. And for each scene, Jacques needs to have this question solved. What is the image of the scene? And that leaves a lot of room then to change on the day everything else, you know, because the image can be a face lit by a little toy with green lasers on the skin of a little boy, for example, and that's in a way the problem of the form of the scene is solved with this answer. And in addition to that, for each scene we tried to have just how do we enter the scene, how do we leave the scene, and that would be the transition between the scenes. That would be something that's almost always is planned, and he actually sticks to the plan on these two elements. But the other elements you have to give credit to art department and of course VFX, because you have like 500 VFX shots in the film. Doesn't mean that it's 500 full VFX shots, but 500 shots where there is either a blue screen or even it's full 3D, for example, when you see a wide of a car riding in the desert. So I think Cédric Fayol, for example, at the supervision of visual effects, did a very good job. And the last thing then, when everything here is on place, is improvisation on the day. And we had a wonderful, for example, Steadicam operator, Sacha Nasseri, who is in the music video world kind of a rock star. He works with a lot of great artists and directors. And Sacha is able to, you know, just use whatever reality is in place and to produce some dynamic shots and creative shots. And something, even things that you cannot really plan, for example. I like the blocking of this scene, El Mal, the dancing at the fundraiser's gala. And that's done because it's like really the combination of the idea of this image, which is a face lit by a pure, strong white light that's controlled by the character, that's able to point it anywhere. And on a kind of black background, but the rest, the blocking, is something that was found on the day with choreographer Damien Jallet, with Zoe dancing and interacting with Sacha, with just maybe this only strong choice, which is to take a 20 mils on a full frame camera on a Steadicam, and then to try to find on every beat what is the right position or the right movement to just tell the story of the scene.
There's so many wonderful things in that sequence too. And you're right about that 20 mil lens. And it's amazing to me that you found much of that choreography and blocking happening on the day. There's, you know, talking about memorable shots, there's this shot where I think that Zoe Saldana is in the foreground and she grabs one of the patrons of the gala and thrusts their head right into her crotch. And it's like this, she's leaning backwards in a camera. And it's like, it's just like an angle I've never seen before. Like, that works so easily. And I probably shouldn't be snapping my fingers near the microphone here, but like, it's on rhythm and it's on pace and it's all part of this dance. I mean, how long did it take to work out that scene? It seems like it's complicated and there's so many shots going on. How long did, was that a full day? Was it a week? Was it a,
this scene was done in 2 days.
But it was
the result of a lot of work on, I mean, Zoe had the dance perfectly done. She was able actually to sing and dance, and it was impressive how, even though we knew that it would be just properly recorded on the set, she was able just to sing and dance in the same moment, and she was just in tune, you know. So there was a huge amount of work that was done already, and we kind of decided of everything that what was the context, and the lighting context was that you would have these strong lights and this lighting operator following her, and everything else was just okay. Now we just can focus on with the space that we will discover in a way where should be the camera on every bit, but it was really the last thing to solve in a way for that sequence.
We don't usually talk about tech in this, but I haven't actually read anything about the tech of this movie, so I feel like I should ask you. And we always get a few people who write to us saying, "Oh, I wish you asked more about some of the tech stuff." Can you talk a little bit just what camera, what lens package you chose for this movie?
Yeah, the movie is shot on Sony Venice 1 and 2, mm-hmm. because of the combination of a wide sensor and the high sensitivity. I'm a strong advocate of film, and whenever I can do that, I'm so happy to do that. But the Jacques is not on the first mm-hmm. hand. He just embraced the, like many directors, how digital is just improving the pace on his films. And but here the reason was like also with the money we had. Because at the time there was no Netflix, it was like a smaller French production that was probably not designed to be exported so much. We didn't have any money even to light the sets for big daylight scenes. So I remember just shrinking some scenes, some exterior scenes, reducing the space, reducing the shots, or doing whatever we can, because the most expensive thing in the studio, strangely, is to do daylight, as opposed very often what's expensive when you shoot outside is to shoot a big night scene, because you need to rent balloons or cranes or anything. But in a studio, what's very complicated is just to have the feeling of the sky and maybe sometimes the feeling of the sun into the sky, and that takes a lot of power of kilowatts. And if you have a camera that's twice as sensitive, then you can cut your lighting list of half, so the difference between ISO 1600 and ISO 3200, for example, can be really like, you can just cut the figures in half on the lighting budget sometimes. So that's a strong reason. And also, when I have more time, I like to, for example, I love the Alexa 35 for many reasons, but there's something that's still unique and proper to the Sony Venice is this Rialto mode that you just can have almost just the lens and the sensor into your hands for some sequence. It's been very useful, especially for car scenes, because you discover when you shoot car scenes in a studio that it's the same limitations as a car scene outside. There is no traffic, that's the only difference, but you just still need to put the camera in weird angles. You always want to be under the windshield or just very low, or you're always against something, you're always using the maximum space you just have. So that's a strong thing. And the other one, which is a detail, but it's the the 0.3 NDs, so you can control internally stop by stop how you control the NDs, which is something that on many cameras and professional cameras you don't necessarily have, and you sometimes a lack of subtlety, and you just have to put a physical ND, and sometimes on some sets, especially with Jax, you don't really have the time for that. So if it's just a little click and then you are just at the right aperture you wanted, it just gives you, you know, this extra control on the image.
Yeah, I think that all of those are perfectly valid justifications. What kind of lenses did you use on the movie?
So we used Tribe 7 T-tuned lenses, just because actually we ran some tests. I felt for a long time that anamorphic was the right tool for this film, because it would just, the problem in a studio is that all the accidents that you didn't provoke won't be there very often. So I felt that combined with practical, especially for the market scene, anamorphic would just bring more texture and accidents to the background. We were losing, obviously, a bit of sharpness, especially with the anamorphic I like, which are more vintage. And I think Jax just didn't recognize himself at all in this image. And we were losing stops also. So I just tried to a different option, and I tested the Blackwing Tribe 7, because being large format lenses, you would just have textures, but just in a different way. I mean,
this movie has received 92 awards and 250 nominations, I believe, now, because of, or at least from IMDb. It's very, very well awarded and notoriety from festivals. You yourself have received several nominations as well, including for a BAFTA and for the BSC awards. Hey, give us a little bit of your background. Tell us, like, where you got the bug. Where did this all come from? You congratulations on so much attention from the for this movie, but tell us where you got your start. How did you start out in this business?
I think as many young people who want to do films, I first thought that maybe there was only, you know, a director that has a career that you can look forward, but I was not from a cinema family. My parents just had one friend who was a line producer, and one day she just decided, okay, I'm going to explain you what's the real life of a director. And she told me about this director finding a subject, finding a producer, starting to write the script, then, you know, meeting actors, and at one point having this meeting with that person, and maybe that the meeting would just take place in a museum, and they would just see painting and say, okay, the movie could just look like, you know, this painting, or that could be the color palette of the film. And I just felt, okay, I want to be that guy that just kicks in at this moment of the process. And that's how I just realized, this job even existed. And I was pretty young. I think I was 12, 13. And from then I just organized to be able to do that later. And I did a cinema school called La Femis, and actually started working in documentaries with director Sébastien Lifshitz on various films. I think we did 5-6 projects together now. And I always kept, I think I did like, today I done like 6 features and 6 feature documentaries. So it's kind of even between those two careers and worlds. And actually it's very relieving to you know, to leave a project and do something completely opposite just for 1 month. And it just, it gives balance, I guess.
Yeah, it's a different muscle, I'm guessing, the documentary versus the narrative. So do you have a preference, or are they just different?
No, I think I often have preferences for what I just, you know, for the opposite of what I just worked on. After a film that's always moving, I'm just dreaming of a film that maybe is still and very photographic, and after a month and a half of documentary, I'm just dreaming to be able to light a scene again, in a way, and just not position myself in the space. So the and working with camera assistants and gaffers and all of these people who just bring, you know, the film that we are doing, the image together. Documentary, I'm kind of alone with my camera and there's a sound engineer and the director, but I pull the focus myself. It's a real different practice. And yeah, I would say just at the end of a project, I just want to do the opposite.
All right. Well, Paul, this has been a great conversation, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. Thanks so much for being on the Cinematography Podcast. Hey, before I let you go, though, is there a place on social media where people can find you? Do you do an Instagram or anything like that if they want to get more of you in their life?
I have an Instagram, but it's not very active. There is
a website.
But the gaffer of the film, they work in a company that's called Electric Park, mm-hmm. and actually shared a lot of how the movie was lit, and they shared a lot of insights. So it's probably more relevant to go there.
All right. Well, what we'll do is we will put a link in the show notes over at camnoir.com to the Instagram account that you mentioned, and yourself. We'll find it and we'll put it there if people want to reach out. Thanks again for being on the show. I can't wait to see what you do next. All right, so that was Paul Guillaume. Hey, thanks so much again for being on the show. It was really great chatting with you about Emilia Perez, and I can't wait to have you back. And congratulations on all of the award love that you've been receiving lately.
Yes, may it continue.
Yeah. All right, so Ben, it is time to pay the bills. We got to thank our fine friends over at Arri. Arri, you might have heard of them. They make cameras.
Never.
They make lenses.
Arri helps make
this show possible. And they also just won a scientific and technical award for the Trinity 2 system. And so for people at home who are like a Trinity 2 system, I don't hear people usually talk about the Trinity 2 system. If you saw the movie 1917, you've seen a Arri Trinity. It is a very, very robust camera stabilizer. And as a matter of fact, the SciTech Awards were awarding a lot of people who are building stabilizing sort of technology. But at Arri, Kurt Schaller for the concept design and development of the Trinity 2 system, and to Dr. Roman Fulton, who is the software and hardware design, the motorized stabilizer head. The Arri Trinity 2 is a body-worn stabilizer system that combines a traditional inertia camera stabilization system, something like a Steadicam, with electronic gimbal technology, allowing unprecedented freedom of camera movement for acquiring shots with multiple transitions that are otherwise unobtainable. So the movie 1917, famously shot on an Arri Trinity, and the whole movie kind of looks like it's all one take. You know, this movie, and it's funny because 1917, also the year that Arri was founded. But I want to say that the Trinity system, which, of course, available from Hot Rod Cameras, is really incredible. It's going to cost you. It's an expensive camera system, stabilizer system, but it is true. It does stuff that basically nothing else out there can do. And the combination...
Like what? Like what does it do that other things don't do? I'm really curious.
Okay, so it has a remote-operated camera head with a body-worn operator. So you've got multiple people who are all, you know, working together. Plus, it's got 360-degree roll axis at the same time as you've got everything else going on. So it's stable.
So is it worn like a Steadicam, or
yes,
is it more like a gimbal?
It's worn like a Steadicam.
So it's got like a vest and an arm.
Yes, it's a gimbal on top of a Steadicam. Now, there have been systems that do portions of the things that the Trinity can do, but it kind of brings them all and marries them together into one unit, which is technically challenging, to say the least. And
I bet
they pull it off in such a brilliant and streamlined and efficient way. It's truly amazing.
And now, short ends.
All right, so Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's the time we talk about our pet obsession. What are you obsessed about this week?
A really cool thing for me Dana Gould is a stand-up comedian and a comedy writer. He was a writer on The Simpsons for a number of years. He created the TV series Stand Against Evil and wrote that. And I just think he's brilliant. And he just released his newest stand-up special. It was like only available on a website called 800 Pound Gorilla for like $10 for like 4 days. And then he put it on YouTube. So it's on YouTube, free for anyone to watch. It's called Dana Gould, Perfectly Normal. And I'm kind of a stand-up nerd. I've always been a fan of stand-up comedy. And I think Dana Gould is honestly one of the best. I think he's one of the best working today.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And I it sounds super cool. Dana Gould is, you know, an institution. He's been around for forever.
Yeah, I feel like he's had a whole lot more success as a writer than he has as a stand-up comedian, although he's been around as a stand-up for a long time. And also, he does a show, and I maybe even talked about it on here before, but he does a show called Hanging with Dr. Z. That's like it's like a fake talk show, mm-hmm. Where he plays Dr. Zaius from the original old-school Planet of the Apes, but he plays him as like a talk show host. So it's like, imagine Dr. Zaius is like Steve Allen era Tonight Show, and he just interviews people as Dr. Zaius, and it's Dana Gould in a full Planet of the Apes makeup, and it's really good. And that's also where I'll make it a double short end for myself. But really, I love his stand up. He has a special from about 10 years ago called I Know It's Wrong, that's just brilliant. But this one's also awesome. They shot it at a Dynasty Typewriter, I think, here in L.A. And I just think he's great. Check it out for free. It's on YouTube. What are you going to do?
That sounds awesome.
All right, Ilya, what is your obsession this week?
Well, sticking with all things British, you know, we talked about the BAFTAs. I also have to throw the BSC Award, the BSC Expo show out there is my pet obsession, my short end this week. It is, in my opinion, probably the best trade show for motion picture equipment. Yes, even possibly better than CineGear.
Than NAB?
Yeah, I think way better than NAB, actually. I think that if you are into the technical side of the motion picture industry, specifically the gear. Yeah, I know that may not be everyone, that may not be you, but if your business is that and you have some sort of connection to the UK market, it's a mandatory. It is the best show for it in the UK. I'm going to say it's the best show in Europe. That means that I think it's better than IBC. And really, when we're talking about, like, you know, CineGear, which probably takes the cake for US based shows, I mean, certainly compared to the last year, the BSC show just feels so, you know, like a well-oiled machine. It feels like it's run really well. With CineGear, it's always like they have something going on, like, oh, there's a giant, you know, international dignitary convention going on when it's at the, you know, Los Angeles Convention Center and no one can get to it. Or it's at this place where it's 115 degrees outside and you know, parking is terrible. They always seem to have something going on. This past year, Warner Brothers was amazing for CineGear, but they were plagued by parking issues. They were plagued by gate issues. They were plagued by all kinds of issues that were preventable. The BSC show, it's like they got their shit down. It is like really, really well organized. It's a massive space. It's kind of like a giant black box. It's at the Battersea, London, which is it's a really incredible, like, you know, world-class expo space. And then they essentially make it a social event while the trade show is going on. You can drink in the trade show, and there's, like, you know, seems to be quite a few like bar stations sort of set up. And sometimes you can't even like get through just walking like a straight path because there's so many people who have run into each other and like are hanging out in the aisles and having like, you know, a real good like get together. In Vegas, you would think there would be more of that going on, but the Vegas Convention Center, the LVCC doesn't really work that way. And, you know, when they do start to like break out beer and stuff, they keep it like very much, you know, locked into like little booths. So there's like a few people crowded in a booth and then no one else can go to it. They can't kind of like be out in the space. The BSC show, it is like a social event as well as, you know, technical exposition. And there's always a few companies that go really like, you know, outside of what they need to in order to give just anyone who wanders into this convention center sort of a unique experience. So like, for example, virtual sets, virtual stages have been really, really big over the last couple of years. This year including, you could like hop into a bumper car and there'd be a virtual background and you could record a little video of yourself doing a thing in like a virtual space. And for people who are, I think, looky-loos or just kind of want a little take-home sort of thing like that, or, hey, look at this funny thing that I did. There's usually about three or four different companies that do that. And because it's got like sort of a dark ceiling and it's sort of like really well light controlled, there's a lot of lighting stuff that goes on and you can strap on body worn stabilizers. I know all kinds of people who go there to try things out and do. It's like, it's a well put together show. And I'm only sorry that I was not available this year to go to it, but I've been watching the stuff as it hits the internet. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. That's a good show. So next year I'll be there. Not this year. I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to track you down outside of this show?
As always, you can find me at benrock.com. And if you'd like to hear the story of how that became my domain after like 20 years of struggle, I don't know, it's probably about a year or two ago that I was talking about it.
So, yeah, our old episodes definitely list that saga that you went through, but you did find
Chronicle. It was a boat website for like since the internet started until like 2 years ago.
That's right.
Anyway, Ilya, where can people find you? You
can find me over at the sponsor of this program, Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. You can also track me down on LinkedIn and Instagram. I got a couple of people reaching out to me on Instagram this week. So
I got some Instagram people going as well. Yeah. And it's like if you reach out to me on any of the social media sites, like drop me a note and say, hey, I listened to the podcast, because otherwise I won't know who you are.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, usually people seem to identify themselves.
I just noticed that like a lot of camera people.
Randos. Yeah.
Well, not randos, but just people in the camera world. You know, they connect with me on LinkedIn or even sometimes Facebook. And it's like, hey, join me on Facebook if you want to hear my political rants and see pictures of my dog.
I get quite a few people on Instagram who do not listen to the podcast and are just trying to sell me like followers or want me to help shoot their OnlyFans content or some other sort of thing that I know is a massive scam. So.
I've never had the OnlyFans.
Oh, really? I've had a couple of those. That's fun. It's like, hey, I could really use you to help shoot my OnlyFans. And I like delete, block. Yeah. You've never had that one, huh?
That's a scam I haven't had. Now I'm like offended that no one's tried to scam me in that way. Like, what's wrong with me?
Anyway. All right. Hey, we got to thank some people. You know, this show is not just, you know, does not just spring organically from the ground. It has to be crafted and forged. Who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible?
As always, we got to thank Alana Cody, who is our hardworking, intrepid and resourceful producer. She's got us tomorrow. We're doing two interviews tomorrow.
Yikes.
So, it's going to be a busy day tomorrow for us. And, you know, when we get to Oscar season, she always gets into high gear, getting everyone who looks like they might be nominated. And then when the nominees drop and we, you know, inevitably one or two, we haven't gotten to them, works hard to get us as many of them as possible. How many have we gotten so far? Have we gotten four of the five? Three of the five?
Well, technically this year we've had all the nominees for cinematography on the podcast before.
Wait, are you kidding me?
No, well, so yeah, so
they have been on at one time.
At one point. So everyone who was nominated this year has been on the show. But four out of the five, Ed Lockman being the only exception, who of course you interviewed, I think, like last year. So
last year for El Conde, which is a great film, mm-hmm. and it's on Netflix and you should check it out. It's so good. Oh my God. So funny and dark and creepy and I just love that movie to pieces. Indeed. Anyway, yeah, he's amazing. So I think that might be our record, though. I think at most we've ever gotten four of the five nominees. But anyway,
you know, this should be a big message to the industry that if you want to get an Academy Award nomination for cinematography, you should just look at people who've been on the Cinematography Podcast.
It's a fair thing to say. Yeah. That's completely fair. And correlation is causation. As science,
always.
Science tells me that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So Ben, who do we have to thank besides Alana Cody?
Besides Alana. Yeah. We have to thank Michael Indispensable Dispenza, who edits the show, and we don't make it easy. And also, last but not least, we got to thank Kay Zalatrakci, who composed all of the music that you hear on this podcast. Check out his website, musicbykays.com. Hire him to compose a score for you. You know, I've been saying this forever. He will compose a score for you in exchange for money, and he's excellent at it.
What? For money?
For money. He'll do it. Yeah. And he does a lot of other stuff, and he's just one of the most multi-talented people I've ever known. But yeah, definitely check out Kay's, musicbykays.com, and you'll find all his links there. So Ilya, would you like to take us out?
Ooh, 2 weeks in a row? Thanks for tuning in.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.